This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and this week we're going to bring you an episode all about two big Supreme Court cases that were argued before the court last week. Now, one of the cases involves transgender care for minors. Another involves the power of federal agencies and specifically involves the FDA and e-cigarettes. When it comes to that second case involving the FDA, we have a guest. I talked to David Ovalle. He is a national reporter focusing on opioids and addiction for the Washington Post. Before we talk to David, I want to bring you my breakdown of what I think is the biggest case of the Supreme Court term. And that's the Scarametti case. And this deals with a Tennessee law, although there are about two dozen plus other state laws that look similar to Tennessee's law that bans gender-affirming care for minors. And the first thing I want to say is it's always dangerous to read too much into oral arguments, but it looks like a majority of the court will be comfortable upholding this law. Now, the law is being challenged on 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause grounds. And a big threshold question for the court is what type of classification this law actually creates. So, the law bans the use of things like puberty blockers and hormone treatment for gender-affirming care, but not for other purposes, like, for instance, to stop the onset of early puberty called precocious puberty. And so part of the Equal Protection Clause question centers on the idea that the same treatment can be used for some people, those seeking to stop early puberty, but not for others, those who are seeking treatment for gender dysphoria. Now, it really, really, again, matters how we treat this classification, because if we view this as a classification on the basis of sex, then we apply a heightened level of review, meaning that judges look at this law with pretty strict eyes, meaning they are really going to kind of put the state law through its paces. They're going to do more than just defer to the state lawmakers and essentially do something along the lines of a rubber stamp. It means they'll look at this law with basically searching eyes. They will really scrutinize it. And that's different from a deferential type of review, which is what we use for other types of classifications. Now, if instead of viewing this law as a sex-based classification, we see it as an age-based classification because it just targets minors, then we would use, again, a more deferential type of review called rational basis. We could also view this as a state law that just directs what type of medical treatments are available. There, again, we would likely use a more deferential type of review. All of which is to say the standard of review really matters, because if you use heightened review, you're much more likely to strike down the state law at issue. Whereas if you use a deferential type of review, rational basis, it's much more likely that the state law will be upheld. So what's the argument here that the state law creates a sex-based classification? It's that Tennessee's law allows a cisgender boy to be prescribed puberty blockers to stop early puberty, but denies a transgender boy being prescribed the same blockers to treat gender dysphoria, as I specifically said before. Now, I did not hear in the arguments last week five justices who were going to accept the challenger's argument that Tennessee's law does, in fact, create a sex-based classification. Some of the justices struggled with whether or not this is really a classification on the basis of transgender status. Again, whether or not it's a classification based on age, whether or not we should view this as a law that really is just limiting certain health care while people are minors. So lots of disagreement about how exactly to classify this law. But what I do want to emphasize is this doesn't necessarily mean that all hope is lost for those who are seeking to challenge this law. And I wrote a little bit about this in a column for MSNBC. Challengers might have more success by citing a different part of the 14th Amendment, and that's the Due Process Clause. A challenge under this part of the 14th Amendment would focus on parents' rights to make choices about their children's medical care, and it would follow a line of cases supporting parents' rights to direct their children's upbringing. Now, to be clear, this would require challengers to bring a new challenge to the Supreme Court. We're talking about a fresh case that could still involve this Tennessee law. And in fact, this argument was brought before the Sixth Circuit in this case. It just wasn't brought to the Supreme Court. So Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar, one of the most gifted Supreme Court advocates, I would say, to ever argue before the court, I think knows that there are significant parental right issues in this case. And in fact, she kicked off her challenge to this state law by saying that under Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care, quote, it doesn't matter what parents decide is best for their children. This is, in fact, the fourth sentence that she uttered in very lengthy arguments. And I think Justice Amy Coney Barrett really picked up on this theme. She said, quote, even if we decided that this wasn't a sex-based classification that triggered intermediate scrutiny, that would not prevent parents from still asserting the substantive due process claim right. So Amy Coney Barrett, I think, is referring to, again, this previous line of cases that talk about parents' rights to direct their child's upbringing. We're talking all the way back over 100 years to a 1923 case where the Supreme Court struck down a Nebraska law that prevented teachers in public or private schools from teaching, quote, any modern language other than English. The court there said that the law unconstitutionally interfered with a parent's liberty interest in raising their children. Just 2 years later, in 1925, the court struck down an Oregon law that required parents of young children to send their kids to public schools only. Here, again, the court concludes the law infringed on parents' liberty to choose which schools to send their children to, and more generally, to direct their children's upbringing. Now, why wasn't this challenge directly brought before the Supreme Court in last week's arguments? Because last week's arguments included both private plaintiffs, including minors seeking gender-affirming care, and the Justice Department. And the Supreme Court agreed to grant the Justice Department's petitions for certification, and that petition focused only on the equal protection arguments. That's because the Biden administration was confined to challenging this Tennessee law, to joining the suit challenging the Tennessee law, based only on equal protection, not due process. Specifically, the Justice Department had to join the case under a law that applies only to challenges, quote, seeking relief from the denial of equal protection. Again, a majority of the justices just don't appear to buy the argument that Tennessee's law is a sex-based classification and that this would create a problem under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, there was a lot of discussion by the conservative members of the court about wanting to leave these questions to the democratic process, and specifically to elected lawmakers, not unelected federal judges. This, however, can present a pretty slippery slope. As Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson forcefully argued, the Supreme Court has long recognized that judges and justices absolutely have a role to play in protecting individual rights, particularly when those rights might be trampled on by the majority via the legislative process, because there's simply no one other than judges who are there to protect those rights when elected branches go too far. Now, the argument that judges must step in because Tennessee's law draws constitutionally invalid lines based on sex appears to be lost. But again, I think the court might be more likely to take action and protect these individual rights under an argument that the state law violates parents' rights to make decisions about their children's medical care. That would be an argument that's made under the Due Process Clause. So I think we need to look for that in the future. Expect a decision on this case about the Equal Protection Clause in June and a challenge about parents' rights potentially to come up next Supreme Court term. So I hope that helped you understand the big transgender rights case. And now please enjoy my conversation with David about the FDA e-cigarettes case. David, thank you so much for joining us. I know that you are busy now, and we're going to focus on a recent Supreme Court case that was just argued this past week, and it deals with not just vaping, but also the power of the FDA. So could you walk us through the legal question in this case and some key factual background here?
Sure. So the FDA is authorized by Congress to regulate tobacco products. And one of those tobacco products is vapes, right? E-cigarettes, vapes. And so it's such an interesting and sort of emerging area of regulation because they're relatively new products, all things considered. And there's been just such a onslaught of applications for marketing authorization for these products, right? And so there's only been, you know, maybe 40 products, 45 products that have been actually approved by FDA, but there's been millions of applications for various products that have been submitted by different companies. And these are not all like big tobacco, you know, RJ Reynolds, Altria kind of thing. These are a lot of sort of smaller companies that make different products or have them manufactured, and they're seeking to sell them and distribute them. So, you know, one of the big sort of sticking points, and this is a kind of a larger public health debate, is over flavored vapes, right? And this isn't like, you know, there's vapes that are just tobacco flavored, or there's some that are just been approved for menthol flavors. But the overwhelming majority of vapes that are popular in this country are the ones with the fruity flavors, you know, mango, blackberry, raspberry, that kind of thing. But the issue with it is also that those are very, very attractive to young people. And so public health authorities have been trying to grasp sort of just how to balance this need that to keep these products away from younger people, but also, you know, give adult smokers who may find these products beneficial to getting off traditional cigarettes that are, you know, really considered much more dangerous than the e-cigarettes themselves, you know, how to give them options. So the FDA has been more hardline in saying, you know, we just don't have enough evidence that these flavored e-cigarettes are better than tobacco flavored ones. And so they've denied millions or more than a million applications. And so most of the appellate courts have ruled in favor of FDA, and they've said, look, the Tobacco Control Act gives the FDA specific authority to basically consider what science they want to use and how to interpret the science. And they've given them a much more specific mandate than we've seen in other legal cases in which agencies have been given deference to interpret ambiguous statutes. The Tobacco Control Act is not that ambiguous, right? So that's been the FDA's position that, look, we have every authority to do this, and we're using the standards that we feel are fit. And sort of this legal fight starts with, as many things, they come before the Supreme Court at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, and they rejected the FDA. They said the FDA acted arbitrarily and capriciously in denying these products for a couple of these companies. So they're really basically second-guessing the FDA and saying, you know, you really, the requirements you were giving these companies, the different scientific studies that you are requiring, were just way too much. And you basically sent the words were a wild goose chase for these companies. And so you need to rethink this and reconsider their application. So here we have this circuit split, and now it's before the Supreme Court. They heard arguments and this week. And so now we just have to wait and see how far the Supreme Court wants to limit, if they want to limit, the power of the FDA to regulate these products.
That was such helpful background in thinking through why this case is important and how it came up to the court. And could you remind us, with respect to the Fifth Circuit, why does this decision that the FDA acted in a way that was arbitrary and capricious, why is that the magic language here? What is the Fifth Circuit really saying?
So it's not unusual for courts to declare that the FDA or some other regulatory body has acted arbitrarily or capriciously in administrative law. Now, I'm no super expert in administrative law, but they can rule that. And I've seen that happen outside of the Fifth. The DC judge recently in a other tobacco related case, you know, also ruled the FDA acted in such a way. But as usual with the Fifth, which has sort of made a habit of striking down regulations or the regulatory powers of federal government, the scope of it seemed much more broad, right? So, you know, the fear by many of the anti-tobacco groups and people who are supporting the agency in this case is that they could really neuter that much more the ability of governments of agencies to be able to interpret the statutes in a way that protects the public, right? So the fear is, let's just say the Supreme Court rules against FDA in a much more broad way, that they would have to basically, it could just upend how this regulation is considered, and they might have to go and just reconsider millions and millions of applications. It may just further hamper their ability and stretch their resources. And oh, by the way, the Tobacco Control Act is very, very specific. So if this isn't specific enough, then what is, right? And that was sort of the issue in the Loper-Bright case was, you know, that this is the famous Chevron doctrine that got reversed is, well, when that there was this deference that the courts gave to agencies to interpret ambiguous statutes. Well, the Tobacco Control Act is really not that ambiguous, you know? Mm-hmm. So if that is not specific enough and they don't have that, then what does? So really just sort of like another big carve out to kind of second guess these agencies. And so that's the real fear.
And could you walk us through a little bit of oral arguments and give us an indication of what the justices are thinking? Obviously, again, we're talking about this case because it goes well beyond vaping and e-cigarettes. And it's really a question of, as you laid out, the power of the FDA and maybe more generally the power of administrative agencies and how much deference the court is going to give now that the Chevron doctrine has been overturned to agencies' interpretations of the statutes that they enforce and execute. And so did we see maybe the typical 6-3 conservative to liberal split when it came to these questions? Were there any surprises? Where does it look like the justices are right now?
Well, you know, that was the interesting thing is I was kind of expecting in listening to the arguments and reading the transcript later that it would be sort of more of that conservative liberal split. But, you know, I think some of the justices, even on the conservative side, seem to really wrestle with the idea that that the FDA didn't have this power under the law, right? So, I mean, even if you go and you look, they read the transcript, they really seemed to be leaning toward FDA having this power. And so one of the things they kept coming back to is, well, you know, there's this big question about, you know, FDA guidance throughout this process of applying to market these vaping products. But at the end of the day, some of them kept coming back to, well, the statute says XYZ, so it's not like you didn't know about this, right? This is the law. I mean, there's big difference between what the statute says and what FDA suggests that you might want to include in your application. And so that's getting really, really into the weeds, but they seem to be leaning toward FDA. So, you know, it is possible that they could issue a ruling that's relatively, that maybe sides with the companies, but is really, really narrow. And at the end of the day, one of the things that struck me, and I can't remember which justice, but it was one of the conservative ones, where they kept saying, well, even if we, like, what is the relief you want? If we say, you know, FDA was wrong and you need to go back and need to reconsider these applications, you always have that option anyways. You can always reapply and get for market authorization and, you know, introduce new science, you know, introduce new studies that say, hey, flavored vapes are perfectly fine for the public, you know? So they seem to be really wrestling with the fact that, you know, it's not like they're sort of limited in how much they could do because, you know, you can always go back and reapply. It's not like this is some thing that's going to completely cut you off from the ability to be able to legally sell these products one day.
That makes a lot of sense in terms of we're now stretching to see now that the Chevron case is no longer a good law, and now that the court isn't going to use that doctrine for deference, like, how are we going to treat decisions by the FDA? So I think that probably brings me to the last big thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is I know I've said, you know, this is more broadly about the power of executive agencies, but I think that feels amorphous to people. And I'm hoping that you can give some indication of what actually does that mean? Are we just talking about the power of the FDA, and therefore, are we talking about the FDA's power when it comes to approving new drugs? Or are we talking about other agencies as well? I mean, how far out could the implications of this case really take us?
Well, I think if you were to make it the worst case scenario for people who believe in a robust regulatory system, then it would be, that would be, you know, that you could pretty much label any very specific statute to be, you know, not specific enough. And you can just kind of shoehorn the arbitrary and capricious into any kind of administrative type of regulation. So I think this is really interesting because, you know, there's so many different interpretations of rules that are so vague. And, you know, you just can't expect lawmakers to literally go in and say, you know, this level of nicotine is bad, or this level of whatever, or you absolutely have to have XYZ type of study in every single, you know, application, right? So, I mean, there's just a level of detail that we just can't expect our lawmakers to be able to craft, right? So really, I think this is going to be a case that's illuminating of just how detailed do our laws need to be, right? And so that's one of the things is sort of like, what's the point between the balance between ambiguity and detail in these, some of these laws? And so that's, you know, I suspect that, I mean, I think the justices are practical. You know, they know that if they, you know, completely upend the FDA's power in this particular case, I mean, that could be very, very, you know, challenging for the government to go back and rewrite the law, or, you know, be able to regulate or approve these products or not approve these products in any kind of meaningful way.
David, that's such a helpful tour of what's happening in this case and why I wanted to talk about it with you. You've been covering the case and talking through really what are the specifics of the particular challenge here? What is the Supreme Court thinking? And how could this impact future cases? So I want to thank you so much for your time. This was a great explainer for me, and I'm sure for our audience as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.